It is Tuesday, August the 25th, and we are going to talk about blood and guts today, all right? You guys love when I talk about blood and guts. Well, it's not going to get much bloodier or guttier than the subject of today. Yesterday, I mentioned the fact that we had crossed over $40 trillion in debt. I also have a segment coming up for you on the expert panel show on Thursday from Dr. Ron Paul and Chris Rossini about that same subject. And I've already recorded that show because I'm in travel this week for West Virginia. More on that in a minute. And so this got my head going on this. And I have always said this was kind of the time frame that we were looking at, you know, real economic collapse of the United States. And when I say always, I'm talking that back in 2008, when I was screaming to you about the stock market, when I first started this show in summer of 08, this is June, before the crash, I was telling this audience, as small as it was back then, get out, get out, get out of the stock market. And when that crash came, there were all kinds of pundits everywhere in real media, regular legacy media, and emerging at the time alternative media screaming, this is the end. And I was very firm in my stance. Get out of the way. Capitalize on the results. There's going to be opportunity here. We're going to go into another startup, the band. Some of you guys remember me telling you that. I called it a false recovery and said it could last over a decade. Well, here we are. Here we are. And today we're going to talk about something that seemed inevitable, and I still wonder if there's one more restart of the casino. I'm not sure, and I'm not even sure it matters if there is. We are in a slow decay. There is a time bomb ticking, and it's the kind of bomb you cannot disarm. We all hear it. We keep hoping some fiscal bomb squad will show up and shut it down, but deep down we know they're not coming. The question is not if the bomb goes off, it is when, and what will the aftermath look like? Run from the blast radius, you say? You can't. $40 trillion in U.S. federal debt is more powerful than any weapon we have ever detonated. But this bomb does not level a city overnight. It corrodes and breaks down societies, institutions, and infrastructure slowly from the inside out. The news gets worse. There's no wire to cut that prevents one of these three triggers from firing. Only one of them needs to spark for this slow motion explosion to rapidly accelerate. Honestly, we're living in something like a bad science fiction analogy. It's like looking at the event horizon of a black hole and noticing there's another starship trapped down inside of it. And then you try to communicate. You try to render aid. Only to realize you're looking at your own ship in a temporal reflection. You're looking at your own future, and it's bleak, even if everything seems fine right now. Today, we are going to look at the U.S. crossing a tipping point from which there is no return. We're going to examine the three triggers that could send the entire system kinetic over the next 10 years. We will talk about adaptation, mitigation, and the very real possibility of perhaps one more can kick down the road, though I don't know how likely it is at this point. But we're also going to look closer to home than Washington, D.C. The average individual and the average family are drowning in debt. So is almost every state, county, and city. So are institutions. Is there any hope? Yes, but it will require individual action. Not a collective rescue. That's just not going to happen. The die has been cast. The game is entering its end stage. The only real question left is, how much time do we have? Pretty dark. But you guys show up for the blood and guts. Unfortunately, what I'm going to give you today is all fact-based. There's no sensationalism in it. I'm not doing it just to get you guys to show up. It just so happens that's how it works here, that when I talk about these things, more people show up, more people download the episode, et cetera, off of, you know, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, et cetera. And I'm going to tell you there is hope. But as always, the hope lands squarely on your own shoulders. With that, before we get into it today, let's go ahead and remind you of a few things, our sponsors of the day and stuff like that. But before I even talk about the sponsors today, I want to throw out like kind of like the last invitation here, I guess, to come meet with me and some other cool people in West Virginia. If you're anywhere near Charleston, West Virginia, you want to pay attention to this. I'm going to be talking about using AI for homeschoolers, but even if you don't homeschool, you're going to learn about using AI to educate yourself or to educate others or to build educational programs, all of those things in this keynote. I'm also sitting on a panel discussion. I was just told by Roy Ramey, who's kind of heading the whole thing up there, that I think my keynote is between 11 and noon, like right before the lunch kind of break time. And then the panel will be after lunch. So, you know, if you get there anytime in the AM, you'll probably be there in time for my keynote. Doors open at 9 and my keynote starts at 11. The other side of it, though, if you can't come or you just want more hanging out with cool people, from 6:30 to 9:30 at the Brick Salt Kitchen and Bar, we are going to be at Marriott Town Center for that. That's their restaurant there. And we'll be having a meetup that will run from 6:30 p.m. to 9:30 p.m. when I will go to bed early so I can get up and get on a plane and come right back home. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and also talk to you guys real quick about the sponsors of the day. Sponsor day number one today is Biltong USA. That's Anton Van Vieren's company. Really great company. They've been sponsoring us now since the dawn of COVID. I think Anton showed up in a live stream. He's probably here right now. He always seems to show up. He showed up in a live stream right when COVID was beginning. His business was pretty much shut down. He had like a little grocery and little restaurant business, and based on a lot of cool imports and stuff from his home country of South Africa and from around the world. And then COVID literally opened it up and shut it down. So he started shipping his Biltong, his Drewers, his Calabanazi sausages and other things across the country, because that was something you could do. It's grown into a great business. If you give his product a try, you'll see why. He makes the best Biltong I have ever had. No exaggeration whatsoever. I also love the Calabanazis, and I really like the sticks, S-T-I-X. This is like a crunchy, drier form of Biltong. It comes in these little strips, and I think it's off the trimmings. It's delicious. I take a pair of shears and cut it into, you know, small bite-sized pieces, because the grain runs long and trying to bite it off, it's pretty tough. But I think you'll like it if you give it a shot. Think meat peanuts, right? That'd be a way to think about it, man. Next up today, KnifeKits.com. Hey, if you want to start making knives, check out KnifeKits.com. Look at this. That's the wood. I wanted to see that knife they had there. Look at the Damascus, right? You can build knives from KnifeKits.com that are beautiful, beautiful, even straight from the kits. They would cost a hell of a lot more money than building it yourself if you were to buy one. It can be the start of a small business, it can be the start of a hobby, or it can just be a great way to create heirlooms to hand down in your family. Imagine if you had a knife you built with your granddad or your great-granddad or something like that. Would you hold on to that forever? I know I would. I wish I had the opportunity to with either of my grandfathers, Andrew or Rex, to have done something like this when I was young. It would have been great. I didn't have that opportunity, but you do today. And KnifeKits.com is one of the longest running sponsors, I would guess, in podcast history. They joined the fold in 2009, and they are still here. I think at this point they are the longest running podcast sponsor for me. It might be globally. I don't know if most podcasts have lasted since 2009. All right, so let's get stuck into it, as they would say. We're not guessing with this subject today. We're just not. This is not a guess. We're mapping timelines that are already in motion. And much of this is actually from Washington's own watchdog groups, the Congressional Budget Office and things like that, right? And if anything, those entities tend to sell a sweeter song than what's really there. Like, they don't want to really give you the bitter pill. They want to mitigate things, but they can't even do that anymore. And what I mean is, when they say something's bad to factor X, it's probably bad to factor X plus 5, is what I mean by that. So, again, this is not, hey, this could happen. This is happening. It's just the speed is very slow. And I want you to think about slow being relative to, right? So we draw a lot of corollaries to Rome's collapse and to the United States' empire and collapse. And things move faster today, but they're still relatively slow to a human lifetime. If you really look into Roman history, you will see a very clear point where Rome had screwed the pooch. It was never going to ever return to its height of greatness, and it was only a drop down forever. It's going to go down forever. And from that point, it took about 300 years for Rome to truly completely collapse. So from the trip point to the end point, 3 centuries. Things move much faster now. And I would say centuries move in decades. It'd be a way to look at it. So when exactly did we trigger this? And I would tell you that it doesn't look real good right about Y2K. Maybe Y2K really was the end of the world as we know it. It just took 30 years to play out or 40 years to play out. And when I get done today, I think you might really have a new appreciation for that. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to go through 3 primary triggers today. It's just like the title says, the 3 triggers to the $40 trillion debt bomb. Every number I'm going to give you today is verified. A lot of it comes from governmental reporting. A lot of it comes from watchdog groups. A lot of it comes from things like the U.S. National Debt Clock, which is just wired into database. I'm not inflating or making anything up. And all 3 of these triggers are something that, you know, economists all over the world look at and are deeply concerned about. It's not like Jack invented this stuff. So trigger number 1 is what I'm going to call silent auction panic. What do I mean by that, right? Like when you hear silent auction, you probably think of some charity and some fundraiser or something like that, right? That's not what we mean here. When we look at how the United States actually sells debt, it's literally an auction, right? It's we say we have X amount of bonds for X amount of price with X amount of interest rate available going on sale on this date. And there's a lot of grab ass in the middle of that, you know, with the Goldman Sachs and such, and a lot of waste in it. But in the end, somebody has to buy the bond, and it's kind of like a silent auction. You put it out there, and you know, people just buy until all the debt that's going on sale for that cycle is gone, if it's gone. And the issue is, it's not like selling, you know, gizmos or widgets or today's item of the day, like knives. Like if you sell, you have 1,000 knives in stock, and you say that, and you sell 800 knives, you still have an inventory of 200 knives, but you're in pretty good shape. Because all you were doing is making a profit per knife. When we sell bonds, we're actually funding our operations. We're not selling anything but a promise. A bond is simply, you give me $100 today, and I promise in 5 years to give you $120 back. You're buying a promise from government, which has always been kept up till now anyway, is one way to look at it. But what happens when nobody buys? What happens when you go, it's all for sale, and not you're a little short? Like, you just don't have people show up. Well, we're looking at a timeline from about 2027 to 2030 where that pinch point becomes a real potential thing. And what's driving it is the debt by 2027, so like this time next year, $41.7 trillion. That's the projected if we don't blow a bunch more money, which we probably will. And we're going to have a budget showdown in the fall of 2027. Why? Because we always do. When do we not have them standing on both sides of the aisle arguing about the debt ceiling, and nobody's actually opposed to raising it, right? Well, of course we're going to raise it. But one side or the other is trying to leverage, and it's usually the Democrats, the left. They want some kind of crazy shit laws passed And they're like, well, raise the debt, but give us our garbage. And then they fight about it. They blame each other and they play grab ass. Well, the issue we have is that we're kind of running up against some things with entitlements at the same in this same time frame over the next 10 years, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, all of that. And this aggravates it. And as the world looks at this, the way I would put it, another shutdown could be like the last straw for debt buyers, for the, like for Japan, for China, right? Like, it was, like you're going to keep playing this freaking game, and we don't know if we're going to get our money back. So maybe we need to stop putting our money into this particular coffer. We have enough of your debt. Think about it this way. Anything you actually invest in, do you not have a point where you're like, okay, I'm going to invest in other things now? Say silver. Like if you stack enough, like the person that has like 5 ounces of silver is probably in the market for more. The person that has a few thousand ounces might be like, bro, I'm not putting more money there. You know, I'm going to stack Bitcoin, or I'm going to buy real estate, or I'm just going to stack cash, or I'm going to buy securities, because you've kind of fooled up. These countries have as much U.S. debt as they need, maybe more than they should at this point. And so if Congress plays chicken, another default, right, that's exactly when global investors might decide to stop showing up to the auctions. The only option then is the Fed buys its own debt, which we do all the time. But there's a difference in we're going to buy some debt to do some quantitative easing. We're going to buy some debt because we're a little short this auction, right? And or we're absorbing all our own debt because no one wants it. That is a fiscal crisis like nothing you've ever seen. That would make what happened from about September of 08 through 2010, that whole cycle, if you're old enough to remember that, guys, that will look like a day at fucking Disneyland if this shit goes down this way. It's kind of like a company doing a reverse stock split when that happens. So a stock split's always a good thing when it's a forward split. That means you had 100 shares of General Electric, and General Electric price went up so high, and the company's doing so well, they literally split the stock and double the shares. It's a form of inflation, but it usually means good things are happening. So you go from having, let's say, 100 shares at $50, now you have 200 shares at $25. And generally, when a stock splits that way, the price goes back up to where it was pretty quickly. There's an entire investment strategy of just buying stocks that are announcing splits, right? But a reverse split is where the company basically contracts it, and you went from having 50 shares to 25 shares at the same price, which immediately begins to go down and tumble. When a company does a reverse split, it is generally one quarter away from announcing a bankruptcy. That's just been the way things have gone down. It's like the last gasp. And so if you have the Federal Reserve not buying some debt, buying most of the debt, all of the debt, you're in a reverse split model. You're at end stage. Do you think that'll happen in 2027? No, but I do think it will begin. I think that we will have that fiscal crisis in D.C. again. I think that one party will be asking for stupid shit the other party's not willing to do. It might be even worse, because I think it's highly likely you have a Democrat House, a thin majority Republican Senate, and a Republican in office who's a lame duck going into an election year for the next presidency. And that could create even more forestalling, especially when the Democrats are going to go all in on investigations and impeachments again if they take the House. That's going to happen. So that's all bad. It all just makes it worse. But I think what ends up happening is you have a shortfall in the auction, but not a complete failure. And that amount, that percentage that the Fed is buying, just has to keep going up. And once that starts, you know, you're looking at maybe 10 years before it all completely unravels. And we're not done yet. That's trigger one. You want trigger two? Do you really? Okay. The math trap on the interest expense. This is basic forward math. Like, this is math that by the time you know sixth grade pre-algebra, you can do this math. It's a big number. You just take a bunch of zeros off it and then expand it back out when you're done if the zeros scare you, and they should. So the best projected timeline for this interest trap to spring is right now to 2036. So an exact 10-year cycle where we're really in the danger zone with this, trying to adjust to something that's going to double very quickly, which is the debt itself. It's again, this is that black hole we're already in. We're already trapped. Everything on the ship seems to be okay. The replicators are screwing up a little bit. You used to be able to get a T-bone, but now you get a burger. And sometimes you can't even get a burger. You get a chicken sandwich or a pack of ramen out of the replicator. But basically, everything's operational and functioning, right? But we already know that we're going down over into the abyss. Net interest costs are going to climb from about $1.1 trillion a year right now. Understand, $1 trillion is a shitload of money. I'd say most countries don't have a $1 trillion budget. We have a multi-trillion dollar budget. But we spend right now about $1.1 trillion to pay the interest on the existing debt. That's how much we have to raise and spend. And one of the ways we're raising it is by inflation. We're just making more money out of thin air to pay that $1 trillion, sucking the value from the money that's in your pocket. Well, where is that debt going to go by 2036? What is the interest payment in 2036 going to be on our debt? $2.1 trillion. You just had a tiny heart attack? Yeah, that's heart attack level shit. That's more than the rate. That's more than we pay right now for the military. That's more than we pay for Social Security. That's more than Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid combined. It's not more than the new military budget is $1.5 trillion. But you can take off the fifth largest department of government, add it to the Department of Defense, the Pentagon total defense budget, and it's still less than that. Where are we going to get the money? We don't have it, and we're not going to have it. We're going to have to print it. While we're trying to see, remember, first trigger, these are all interlaced. This is like a master crazy bomber. If you shut down one trigger, the other trigger goes off. But if one trigger goes off, they all go off. Kind of like that in a sequence. Like a three-cycle explosion. That's what we're looking at here. Right now, one out of every $6 your government spends, I should say wastes, goes to pay this interest. So if you pay $6 in federal tax, $1 of that is just to fund the existing debt. That's by their numbers, which I don't even believe, by the way. I think it's actually worse than that when you look at all of the expense associated with the debt. That's just a raw interest payment, $1 in $6. How the hell is this going to work, right? And the answer is it's not. And that's going to double in the next 10 years. And even if we can pay it, what does this say about inflation? Right? What is a cup of coffee going to cost by the year 2036? And when you do that math, you're like, that's no. But if you did that math 10 years ago about today, you would have said the same thing. And there has to be a point where that last straw goes on the back of the camel, and we're getting there. And then trigger three, and if these two continue at the rate that they're already, because these are both happening already, this third one will also continue and accelerate because it's already also in motion. This is what I call King Dollar loses his crown. This is the entire 2030s. Married up with entitlement deadlines. We already know, like, if we don't figure something out, and we're not gonna, because they don't figure things out, do they? Then I think it's 2034 or 2036. Right now, as projected, they would have to cut Social Security by 20%. Do you know anybody living on Social Security? Do you know anybody that's truly dependent on Social Security that's doing well with what they have now? Do you think they would be able to do well with a 20% cut to what they're getting now? Yeah, I don't either. But that is going to line up with this, right? So to keep the reserve status, we also have to be the debt that everybody buys from the prior two triggers. And if you're a country out there looking at this and you're watching the wealthiest country in the world go through forced austerity, because that's what it will be, and it's unlikely that it will change and not happen, you start to really think, like, why are we so invested in this monetary system of theirs, right? And so right now we are the reserve currency, but why were we made the reserve currency specifically after World War II? Because the rest of the world was in a shambles. Like, if you, like, Africa was not developed, it still really isn't, okay? South America wasn't really either, other than some level of development in Argentina. Yet Canada, they didn't have enough people or enough capacity. So where's the developed world at this point? Where would you have called the world developed? Europe? Japan. Now, what was the state of Europe and Japan in 1946? Effed. Leveled. Rubble. So you needed somebody in the developed world to create this new economic system that had stability. And everybody looked and said, well, nobody bombed the shit out of the United States under that little thing that they, when they messed with the boats in Honolulu, and we don't ever want to do that shit again. Don't touch the boats. They have incredible manufacturing capacity there. They're the breadbasket of the world, right? They can feed the planet. They have a shit ton of gold. They have more gold than anybody else. Yeah, it makes sense. We'll take every other global currency, peg it to the dollar, and back the dollar with gold. And hence, we have a global gold standard. That's the deal we made in the 1940s, okay? By 1971, less than 30 years into the deal, we reneged on the deal. But let's not forget that we reneged in phases, because that's what's happening now, too, phases of reneging on deals. So by 1964, we went, yeah, we're gonna do a little thing with the money. Right? We're going to take the silver out of the quarter and the dime and the 50-cent piece and the dollar. So we're going to take this quarter that used to be roughly about 0.2 ounces. It wasn't a full quarter ounce, right? But 0.2, let's say 0.2 ounces of silver, and we're going to replace it with copper and zinc that's worth nothing. And so that was a default on our monetary pledge right there. Then we were printing money we didn't have. We were creating dollars and sending them out in the world to aid our allies who were rebuilding, right? Who are former enemies who were rebuilding that were now our allies. And we were fighting the Soviets and everything. So all these little things. And the bankers started doing their fractional reserve thing even before 71. And a lot of people in the world started to go, there's no way you have that much gold. And the French, specifically with Charles de Gaulle, said, hey, whoa. You say you, okay, fine. Give us the gold. And every time they came into a bunch of U.S. dollars, they were cashing it in. So then Nixon gets blamed for closing the gold window, but there was no window already. There was way too much money on the outside for the window to fill from the inside. And so what Nixon really did, he's like the doctor. Like, he gets blamed for the guy dying because he walks in the hospital and they go, the guy with 17 forms of cancer in there? Yeah, you need to go check on him. And he walks in, he goes, I guess you guys aren't paying attention. He's dead. And they say, you killed him. Well, it was all the other doctors that didn't treat his 17 cancers that killed him, if anything. Right? It wasn't the last doctor. So Nixon calls time of death on that. And immediately we go into parabolic money printing that has never slowed down since. So we made the deal on stability and we don't have any. So why would they keep their part of the deal? Why do we get to keep a trade advantage for another 100 years or some shit? Because we have the most stable currency. But what we have is the least smelly shirt in the hamper and we're all out of clean clothes. That's the only reason we have made it this far. But things are changing. And again, we got to look at entitlements. And whenever you say that, you cut it. You want to steal from people. I'm just doing math, man. Right? I'm just calling balls and strikes here. I'm not advocating for anything because I don't think it matters at this point. we don't have the money to continue funding Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and all the other crazy shit the left thinks we can just add on and keep funding more and more and more by taxing the rich. There's no taxing the rich out of this. That's not a thing. It doesn't work. It never has. So we have to stop believing in that we can do this thing that everybody has already tried and it never worked. Like, do you think the people running the show today are so brilliant they'll be able to do something better than the people who ran the show 100 years ago? If you answered that with a yes, I'm going to write you off and I don't want to talk to you anymore. Because the average intellect of a person, let's say in their 40s in 2026, is a joke compared to the intellect of a high school student in 1926. I'm sorry, it's true. Okay, those people also didn't have a fractional reserve banking system untethered to gold, so they could only get themselves into so much trouble. So as we get into this kind of fiscal cliff and these funding cliffs for these programs, the international trade is slowly abandoning the dollar already. Like, a lot is made of the BRICS nations and all, but what we really haven't taken seriously is the fact that mutual destruction is no longer really the deterrent that it used to be. We changed the game. We broke the final piece of trust in our proxy war with Russia. Does anybody in the live stream know what I'm talking about when I say that? We broke the final trust that there was. Us, along with our allies in the EU and the UK, seized $300 billion in Russian bank assets that were outside of Russia, denominated in U.S. dollars. We basically said, you don't need that $300 billion, Vlad. We're going to just take it so we can help our Ukrainian friends. Well, there's a consequence of that, a second, third order type consequence spiral that begins. So now if you're any nation anywhere in the world that's been doing business under this global reserve standard and you have assets denominated in dollars outside of your country, which every country does, the message is if you piss the United States off, we'll just seize your assets. And if your assets happen to be in another country, their assets are also outside of that country. We'll leverage them. They'll do our work for us because we'll make them. We'll put our thumb on the scale against you. And if they screw with us, we'll grab their assets. And then we'll see how safe your assets in dollars are in their country. And by the way, they're in dollars anyway, so we can always fuck with that. This is the world that we live in now, not the world we're heading into. We're already there. We now have China's CIPS, C-I-P-S system, which is cross-border interbank payment system. That's a system. It competes with what we call SWIFT. That's our system. And Russia has SPFS, right? That's their system for cross-border payments. So the two biggest countries other than us, the two economic giants other than us, have cross-border payment systems, and they haven't broken trust. Right. For as totalitarian as China is, to a lesser degree, Russia is, both of those countries tend to be good economic actors in the world in that they don't steal other people's money. They're very shrewd negotiators, especially the Chinese. They're very big on manipulation of their own currency to maintain a spread that allows them a trading advantage. But they don't seize other people's money. They seize their citizens' money, but they don't seize other countries' money because they know long term that's bad for business. So there are alternatives for nations. Like if Chile wants to trade with Argentina, they don't have to use the dollar. That's the only point. Plus, we have the Bitcoin angle we'll get to in a minute. There's countries that are doing business in that, and that may continue. But there is nothing that prevents any sovereign nation from strengthening its currency, making it more appealing than the dollar, and offering an alternative for global trade. Because all those countries really care about is the transaction. And while the trade in the center is settled in dollars, eventually people want in their own country, on the street, more pesos, more rubles, more rupees, more yen, whatever it is. That's what they really want. They sell a thing to gain a thing, or they offer a service to gain a thing, and they do business in their own borders in their own currency. and giving that up as the last breath of sovereignty for a nation. So that's all moving in that direction, King Dollar losing its crown. And the world seems to be deciding maybe it doesn't need a reserve currency at all. The big intellectual defense here has always been the least smelly shirt in the hamper, one way or another. It's mutually assured destruction. If any country takes us on and everybody divests of U.S. debt, they destroy their own wealth. But what if we don't need, why do we have a world reserve currency? Other than so that one nation can have an advantage over everybody else being empowered and controlled. What need is there for a reserve currency? And to understand the power of a reserve currency, I want you to think about it like this. Let's say that sounds stupid, but it's just an analogy so you can understand it. The reserve currency of the United States became oranges. Okay? And what that would mean is if Oklahoma wanted to buy something from Nebraska, let's say cattle, before they made the transaction, instead of using U.S. dollars or Oklahoma bucks or whatever, they would have to purchase oranges, use oranges in the exchange, and then convert it back to their Oklahoma bucks or dollars or whatever. That's how reserve currency functions. The petrodollar, that's what they're talking about. Nation A wants to buy oil from Nation B, and one uses, you know, X currency, the other uses Y currency, but they have to do the transaction in dollars. That's been the model for a very long time. That countries have been stepping out of that more and more and more. And if you are anybody but us, do you really have a vested interest in maintaining the concept of a global currency? Shouldn't currencies just float against each other in the natural market of things? Why can't China do business with India and they handle their own currency differential? China gives them, you know, the Chinese renminbi or whatever the hell it is, and then India just converts it to Indian rupees or whatever the hell India uses. What need is there for a dollar in this system? And the answer is the need is artificially created. We don't need it. So if you don't need it and it's hurting you, don't you eventually try to cut the tether and get off of that? So those are the three things going together that are leading us down this road. And I really think that's where we're headed. Like, there was this idea at one point that they were going to create this BRICS currency, or China was going to create a gold currency or what have you. And I think the world is coming to the idea that maybe it would just be better if there wasn't one. Maybe it would just be better if we all dealt with our own shit. Maybe nobody should be in charge of the global monetary supply. And that's bad for us because we've built everything we have on the concept, the insane concept, that not only do we have this advantage, but we would have this advantage forever. I mean, there's people right now, if you tell them what I'm telling you right now about losing reserve currency status, they'll just laugh at you. Despite everything else I've told you about the weakness of the dollar as the reserve currency standard, or why it was became the world global standard in the first place. So here's the thing. It's not just the Fed. I want to give you some other kind of real quick lightning round type numbers here to really let it sink in. If you look at all 50 states, and the states all owe money too, and this is not taxpayers. This is everybody. If you had a baby yesterday, your baby has this debt on top of their back, in addition to the $40 trillion, their share of that. $3,200 per citizen. Doesn't sound so bad, but it's on top of everything else. So, and that number is prorated across the entire country against all people that live here. Taxpayers, non-taxpayers, adults, children, retirees, disabled, fully able, all of it. Okay. And that number would be much higher in Texas than it would probably be in Missouri. So that's just an aggregate average. And so when I say state debt, $3,200 per citizen, you think, oh, well, that's not so bad. Well, clearly there's other governmental entities that borrow money. And if I tell you local debt per citizen, you would think, well, that must be lower. It's not. And most of this is tied up in funding schools because it's local debt that funds schools and local property taxes that fund schools. And that's the biggest institution in the country, really, is the educational institution. And that is $6,700 per citizen. So every person walking around with a heartbeat in this country owes roughly $10,000 in debt that's growing every day, just in local and state debt. Your baby that you just fed with a bottle, or if you're a mom, you breastfed or whatever, owes $10,000 just in state and local debt. Okay? The federal, state, and local fraud, right? For all the DOGE is going to save everything. Fraud costs us per citizen combined, federal, state, and local. That's, you know, the guy's brother-in-law getting the highway contract that he milks, all of it. USAID, that's gone, but a lot of what it does is still there. It's all the fraud that we can estimate. So again, this number would be low, $11,000 per citizen, $11,600 to be exact, per year. Fraud costs us per individual almost $12,000 a year, and that number is growing. You go to Debt Clock and you can watch it grow. Okay. The hidden Federal Reserve tax, the cost of operating all this debt, the cost of all this money printing, the cost, the administrative costs that are absorbed into multiple departments through the fractional reserve system run by the Fed. You want to take a guess on what that costs you a year? Per citizen. Again, this is not taxpayers. This is everybody, babies to people that are a day from the grave. I just don't want to tell you this number. $21,000 per citizen per year to fund this nonsense, to fund this system that's created this cancer and this decay. We're all paying, in future earnings potential anyway, $21,000 a year. This includes the devaluing of your money. So it's not necessarily money that you're going to pay out of pocket outright. This includes the effect of inflation. $21,000 per citizen, cradle to grave, per year and growing. How can this not break? Here's another way of looking at this. There's about 340 million people in the United States right now. Total 340 million people. Everybody, all in. That's where those aggregate numbers come from. How many of those people do you think pay taxes at a federal level? They pay any federal tax? Does anybody have any idea what that number is? 100 million. It's like 109 million or something, roughly 100 million people. So 100 million people are paying all the taxes at the federal level that fund the country for 340 million people. 100 million people are carrying 240 million people on their backs. Now, some of those people that are being carried, you know, they're retirees or their children. But we're going to get to that next. 106 million people are not in the labor force in 2026. When I say 106 million are not in the labor force, that is not all the retirees and children. There's 106 million people that could, in theory, engage in some form of work, labor, or employment who are not. Remember I talked about yesterday how a life goal has become to get on some form of government assistance disability and consider yourself retired for the rest of your life? A lot of those 106 million people are those people. Now, they're also stay-at-home moms. But again, they're not contributing to the labor base. They're not contributing to the tax base. I don't have a problem with that decision, but this is just the raw numbers here. Now, this is what's interesting. In the year 2000, there were only 84 million people not in the workforce. 84 million versus 106 million. But in 2000, there was a population in the United States of roughly 280 million. That means there was a lot more workers relative to non-workers back then. The percentage was almost half. Now it's about a third. It's less than a third. That's how far we've fallen in 26 years. Remember I said about centuries in Rome moving in decades in our republic? That's what that looks like. Okay. How about this? How many people do you think in this country are on food stamps? 35 million. 35 million. And that number is higher because that's recipients. So if you're a family, let's say a woman and three children, that's four people being supported with it, but it's one recipient on the books. That's how that works out. So we have 35 million, more accurately, families, because the majority, if not all, but the majority of people on food stamps is more than one party that's actually benefiting from those food stamps. And I know it's always smart to debate. People are hungry. You want to steal it? I'm just giving you numbers. I'm just giving you numbers here. That's still harsh reality. And let me tell you something. I remember back around 2012, 2013-ish, driving through Arkansas when I lived there. I don't remember where I was going. But I'm driving through, and I'm listening to AM radio, and I'm trying to find anything that's like talk radio, news, et cetera, just for information. Finally find a channel that seems like it's going to give me some information. Commercial break comes on. I can tell you it had to be around 2011. Obama was still president, so maybe 2012. This ad comes on, and the ad was basically two people talking, and one saying they were on food stamps, and the other one saying, that's good for you, I guess. And they're like, you should check, see if you qualify. It's like, but I'm getting by. It's, yeah, but a little assistance helps. And this was run by the federal government. And the message was, hey, look, we know you're getting by, but we might have benefits you can access that will help you. And there's people that would think, well, what's wrong with letting people know that? Why would you do that? I want you guys to use your critical thinking hats here for about 30 seconds on your own without me giving you the answer. Why would a government advertise to get more people onto a form of financial aid and assistance? Why? Because people defend what matters to them. And if you want people to defend government, make them dependent on government. It is that simple. So 35 million families on food stamps, private debt per citizen. Because we want to owe all the money to the government. Well, how much money do we owe? $63,000 per citizen. But that is only, that's not children, that's just adults, right? Because children don't have debt, except for all the debt the government ran up on their name. But that's just adults. But if you take out all the people who have no debt at all because they can't get any, like they're too poor or they're on government assistance and retired, so no one will lend them any money. If you only look at people who hold debt, then that number is $105,000 per individual. So the average person in America owes $105,000. Some people owe a lot more, some a lot less, but that's the median. That's the average. It's actually the average, not the median. Median and average are a little bit different. Do you know who owes the most out of all the generational cohorts? Us, Gen X, not boomers, because boomers have been in their houses so long that their debt ratio has compensated, right? And many of the boomers have their houses paid off or very close to paid off, right? The millennials are still trying to become homeowners, at least half of their generation, and Gen Z is screwed and can't get a house. So that limits the amount of debt that they all carry. Most of the debt of the younger millennial, like the bottom half of the millennial cohort in age, and Gen Z is in student loan debt and automobile debt. That's the two big expenses they have that are debt ratioed. They have the same kind of housing expense. They're just paying a landlord instead of their own mortgage. But they're not paying property taxes. Yeah, they are. Yeah, they're. You people that think by renting you avoid property taxes, you're insane. There ain't a landlord anywhere that doesn't have a line item for property taxes, including projected growth in their rental spreadsheet where they decide how much money they're going to charge you. They're the ones not paying property tax. If you want to get out of paying property tax, become a landlord and get somebody else, a tenant, to pay it for you while they buy the equity in the buildings for you. That's how that works, okay? So when I look at all this, I also look at, you know, the last 20 years. I've been doing this show almost 20 years. And there were a lot of people that said what I'm saying now 20 years ago, and I said they were wrong. And I was right, and they were wrong. I guess I got lucky or the world got lucky. I don't know. So that always makes me gut check myself just because this is all happening when I said it would 20 years ago. The way I said it would happen. Does that mean I'm right? No, it does not. This is a very complex web of shit. And that's the best way to describe it. Complex web of shit. right? That you cannot avoid, you cannot operate completely outside of. It is impossible. It's interwebbed through everything in society. Everything you buy, everything you sell, every job you do, every time you get a paycheck, no matter what, I don't care if you live on Bitcoin, whatever, you're living off a system that feeds on this fiat system, no matter what you personally do. What you do matters. We're going to talk about that in a second. Could there be, though, some way that they refinagle this? I have forecasted also with this what I call the rebasing of the dollar, some sort of major shift internally on how we actually back the money, some sort of devaluation of the debt. I'm at a loss to how you do it now. There was a lot of potential for it to happen 15 years ago. There's not, I don't see much left, but there's always a scam they can run to try to just push it out. And remember, politicians don't care about solving a problem for your kids. They care about solving a problem for themselves. The majority of politicians are 50, 60 years old at the federal level or older, right? Mitch, right? Wherever the hell he is. They only have to push this out another 10, 15 years where they're scot-free and out of the game. And they want to get as much control as they can in that time. So the other side of this is while they're kicking the can, this is a great, remember when I did a segment 2 weeks ago about how you sell communism to kids, kids being 20-year-olds? Communism's like a baseball bat wrapped in concertina wire. And if I hand it out to you, say, grab on it and I'll pull you up and you need to get 2 foot up of a wall, you're not going to grab it. You'll climb up the wall on your own. But if you're in violent current water, and that just happens to be the only thing I have, and I'm not shredding my hand to get you out, and I put that, you'll sacrifice your hands to get out of that water because you think you're going to drown. That's this. This is when you sell communism to the greatest nation that ever lived. This is when you sell your senior citizens on it with, it's the only way we'll be able to keep you on Social Security and Medicare. This is when you go to your bottom half and go, without this, that Medicaid that you know pays for all your kids' health care and shit, it's going to go away. You go to the 20-somethings and go, you're right, you're never going to own a house unless we do this. And then everybody gets a house. This is going to be a big pitch for the communists. And I'm not going to call them socialists. I'm going to call them what the fuck? They are communists. This is communism. And communism is always the end result of socialism. And what you've been living under for the past 100 years and people told you was capitalism is a lie. You've been living under socialisms, socialism light to socialism moderate to socialism advanced, right? And people say, but Jack, you always say it's fascist. And I also always say fascism is what? A form of socialism. It's sort of a middle ground. It's a conversion period that leads always to the same place. Full socialism and full socialism is communism. The reason we call them communists now, they call themselves communists, right? When someone tells me they're a fucking communist, I don't go, oh, it's actually socialism, right? When somebody tells me what they are, I believe them. When somebody shows me what they are, I believe them. Why do you think all of these cockroaches from the Democrat Socialist America are coming out from under the rocks now and saying the quiet parts out loud? They know their time's at hand. They either capitalize on this or they don't. This is their opportunity. Now, I will tell you, I think they moved a little quick. And the biggest gift the left has given the right this year is nominating these full-on communists. People are so dissatisfied. They'll vote for anybody different. But there's a lot of places they put these people up, like Tallarico in Texas. He's polling higher than Ken Paxton. Where? At University of Texas Austin, when you ask 19-year-olds who want their student debt forgiven? No. No, that dude's toast. That crazy bitch out in Florida, she ain't winning either. But the three House rep nominees in Manhattan, yeah, they're going to win. We're going to have overt communists, maybe one senator, definitely more than a half dozen sitting in our House of Representatives at the end of this cycle. If the Republicans hold on by the skin of their teeth, it will only be how brazen they were. And I don't know that it won't work in 28, which might be the entire plan right here. Now, there is a thing. Rules for Radicals tells us what? You don't want to be in charge when the crisis hits. You want to be out of power when the crisis hits, and you want to use the crisis to seize power. So if they seize it a little bit too early, we'll see. But again, what is their actual goal? What is the goal of the left if you take it in the full macro? And I'm not talking about individual, like healthcare for all, whatever. The goal of the left is for the government to manage as much as possible and make people dependent on government, because people will defend the thing they're dependent upon. It's an interesting thing. Become dependent on anything. Not even like dependent, become advantaged by something. Like if you have a side hustle business and it's in a certain sector of the market and you don't really need it, but you make an extra $30,000 a year off of it and your life's a lot better because of it. Before you had that, if somebody said, we need to do like tax this sector or shut it down or whatever, you might've been like, I don't like that, but whatever. But once you're benefiting from it, you'll go to war for it, right? You'll go to war for it. That's the left plan. That's why the left advertises food stamps. If you can get people on the dole at any level, then a threat to government is a threat to them. That's united we stand. Yeah, that's what they really mean. That's how you unite people. You cobble together dependency. So what can we do about it? What are the things we can do about it, right? I like to give solutions. There's not a lot of great solutions here. You can't run away. You can't escape. What you can do, though, is, you know, the communists always want to seize the means of production. That's because they can't build the means of production. Communists destroy because they can't create. Marx himself wrote one time something like, I am the destroyer, right? Like some poem he wrote before his manifesto. And this is because communists literally know. In fact, the entire plan of Marxism is, we can't build the world we want to take over. We need to let them build it and then take it over. Like, go actually read Marx and you'll find that's exactly the plan. Allow the industrialists to build the industrial might and then seize it, because they know they can't build it, right? So what do we need to do? We actually need to build actual means of production for essentials today for ourselves. That can be collectively, and it can be individually. If you build a house that produces its own power, like we just talked about last week with Ryan on Beyond the Generator, now you don't care as much about the electrical grid. You still care because everybody else is on it. Or maybe you're only producing like half your power, but then the cost of your power goes in half, even though the electric bill keeps going up for everybody else. Yours actually goes down relative to your total expense, and you can keep building on that. That would be an individual means of production. A garden is an individual means of production. You know, but we talked about like ways around the meat cartel yesterday. 20 people living in the same relative area, not necessarily next door neighbors, and one of them has a great big pasture, and everybody goes in together on something like a cow share or a herd share with sheep or something like that. And that money then is pulled to actually pay the labor of one or two people that actually look after the animals. And then there's the collective cost of, you know, meat processing and all. And it's all inside something like a private members association or a herd share LLC or something like that. And that doesn't just drive the actual cost of the product down. It puts control of the product in the hands of the people that benefit from it. That would be a means of production that is collectively owned. That's socialism. It's actually a socialism. I've never had a problem with the word socialism as an adjective, only as a system. That is voluntary tribal cooperation, right, that anybody can be part of or not part of. In fact, not anybody can be part of. That's actually the bigger point. Not everybody gets in. That system doesn't have anybody with their feet up while everybody else pedals the multi-pedal bike. Right? You ever see those things like where like there's a dude, like they do them in like cities that are party cities and shit like that. Like there's a dude sitting on, I think it looks like a trolley, and it's got like a bar and everybody's drinking booze, but everybody's pedaling, right? And they kind of pedal sideways, but the thing goes vertical, right? And there's a dude in the front who's like steering it, but he's not pedaling. You paid him to get on and pedal so he could ride around while you drink and he could make money. That's socialism as a system. Socialism as a voluntary participant is an equal participant either economically or with labor. So I don't want to go out every day and move the sheep, but I'm willing to pay somebody to do it for me. And instead of doing it through a giant multi-layered marketing solution that has that Federal Reserve tax attached to it, you bring it down hyperlocal. You bring feed down by putting the animal on grass, and the grass gets better the longer the animal eats it. That would be one collective means. And you could go from there, come up with more, because one's not enough. Next, you need to stack hard assets. That would be Bitcoin. That would be gold. That would be silver. And F off with your second best cryptos. I'm not interested. That was also housing, tools, productive systems of your own, right? Means of productions are also hard assets. So if you build yourself a small, let's say, hydroponic or aquaponic system, and it makes you herbs, right? That's a productive asset. In fact, it's directly correlated. You can literally calculate the value. And if you have surplus, you can sell it in local trade. I want to say something about Bitcoin, though, because I want to make sure people don't think that I'm such a Bitcoin bull that I'm saying it's completely invulnerable to anything. When all this shit happens, don't think Bitcoin won't go down in price, up in price, down in price, and be volatile still. It will. A lot of Bitcoin's value is derived from the fact that people exchange dollars for it. When people need to sell it because they need money and there's not enough people to buy it, you can drive the price with negative pressure as well. Long term, I think it is the best bet you have, but you need other hard assets built into this. In other words, if I'm sitting and like my hard monetary assets are primarily, let's say, Bitcoin and silver, and Bitcoin's in a pushed down price and silver's in an inflated price, and I have to sell one or the other, which one am I going to sell? I'm going to sell the silver. If all I have is Bitcoin, what am I going to sell? Well, I'm going to sell the Bitcoin. Or what am I going to borrow against if I'm going to play that game? Well, I'm going to borrow against the thing that I have that I have to. Whereas if the value of something is depressed and I want to leverage it, I want to borrow against the thing low in price that's down, as long as I don't think it's falling to the floor, right? But it's pushed down. Let's say it's pushed down 40, 50%. That's a great time to take a loan against it. It's counterintuitive, but as the asset recovers, my loan-to-value ratio improves on my end, where if I borrow against it when it's high, that's when I want to sell, but I don't want to borrow against something when it's high. I want to borrow against something when it's low. So you sell high, you borrow low. That's actually the wealth format that wealthy people have used for thousands of years. Now, the other thing you can do is build businesses that are resilient and adaptable. And I believe in this market that we're in, this timeline that we're in, you need to be using AI in that. I don't give a shit if you have a used tire store. Use AI. Because you know what you need in a used tire store? Customers buying your used tires. You need to attract eyeballs. You need to tell your story. Why would somebody come buy your used tire instead of going to Firestone and buy a new one? And my dad used to do that business. That's why I brought it. It doesn't really matter what it is. You can be a plumber. Plumbers are very safe from AI taking their jobs. You're not going to have an Optimus robot show up at your house and fix your plumbing. It is too variable and complex. Automation for the time being is still going to be very much things that are the same every time. In other words, an Optimus robot will be able to build a Tesla Cybertruck, but every piece goes to the same place every time. If you run electrical conduit or something like that and you get into a building and the blueprint says run it here and you look and over that doorway is a header that you can't put another penetration in, that technician has to figure out how to make it work within compliance, right? So those things are going to be taken away. That doesn't mean that AI doesn't play a role in how they do their jobs and how they operate their business. And on that, I don't know how many, but I know we still have some seats left in the AI course that went live this morning. If you think you need a business, take this course. Learn how to build business. Learn how to attract buyers. It's going to be one of the most important things in the future because our economy can collapse but not go away. Like, if you look back at what people went through in the Great Depression, it was horrible. Do you know what also happened in the Great Depression? People built fortunes. Some of the biggest companies in business today were built during the Great Depression. In other words, they didn't even exist before the Great Depression. Some of the biggest companies today existed before the Depression, but they actually grew through the Great Depression up leading up to World War II. Entrepreneurship is the most underrated, undervalued skill in society today. And now people think it is being a retard that blows your balls off on YouTube for likes. Or being some hot chick that shows her ass a certain way, right? I'm not even putting anybody down that does it. I'm just saying that's not entrepreneurship. You're capitalizing on fads. And fads have a way of waning pretty quickly, coming and going, right? You know, a guy made how much money with a pet rock? Well, if you adjust it for inflation today, Gary Dahl, I think was his name, made about $7.5 million selling a rock with googly eyes in a box. In the height of the 70s recession, which if you're old enough to remember was pretty tough times. Pretty tough times. $7.5 million. Don't worry about it. It was like $1.4 million or something. It doesn't matter what it was then because your head doesn't understand what you can buy with $1.4 million versus $7.5 million today. But $7.5 million, you can get your head around. You'd be like, oh, this is what I can do. $7.5 million, most of you, even with all this shit coming, if I gave you that right now, you're especially if you're over 40, you could quit working, live for the rest of your life, and never want for shit. That doesn't mean you could spend money like a retard, but you would be fine, right? That's how much money a guy made selling a rock because he had a compelling marketing story to go with it. The most valuable thing you can come up with if you want to be an entrepreneur, other than the thing you're going to market, is the marketing itself. How you capture leads, how you develop things like a lead magnet, and a value ladder and things like that. So in that course, we teach all that. So if you don't know what business you want to start yet, as long as you think you know, you can take that course. $300 well spent, a value that keeps on giving. And I had several people this cycle, like, I want to take a course again. How do I sign up to take it again? Do I get to do it? You don't have to do anything. You get to take it again for the rest of your life if you want to, as long as we do it. So it is a recurring value as well. I was spitballing with some other ideas for courses with Tom today, and I'd be interested to know if anybody would like this one. What about a simple course, like a 10-day self-led course, and the entire purpose is for the person that doesn't know what business to go into to discover the right business for them? If you'd be interested in that, let me know. You can let me know in the live chat. You can send me an email, whatever. Just don't use DMs on social. That's a really bad way to get in touch with me. I'm shitty about it. I really am. Actually, about the only place I actually check my DMs is my least favorite site. It's LinkedIn and maybe X, but like Facebook and shit. Like if you're using Facebook Messenger to talk to me, it's not even on my phone. Okay. I won't ever see it. You need to email me TSPC in the subject line, but man, you need to be building businesses that are resilient and adaptable. And again, you have to use AI at this point because business is always competitive. Like when somebody tells me like, I'm going to go in this business because there's no competition, I'm like, then there's no market. Like it is very rare that a person without business experience, without a successful track record, can go into a business sector and create a market where it doesn't exist. That's an incredibly advanced place to be. And it's much harder than it sounds. Now there's first mover advantage, but those are usually within markets. You're tweaking something, you're finding a niche or an angle. That's totally different than creating a market. So you're always competing with somebody or you're in no market at all. And who you compete with is going to use AI. And this is, I can't remember the principle. There's like Pareto principle, but that's the 80-20 thing. There is a principle of this to why new businesses always have advantages. And it's because the new business looks around and says, what are the tools available to promote my business today? And that person will buy anything and everything, including stupid little things. Here's an example. When I started building this show, I guarantee you this thing doesn't exist anymore. There used to be, and it was a browser extension that went in like Firefox browsers, Chrome-based browsers and stuff back in 08. It was called StumbleUpon. And you would download this little thing and you would set up a profile. And when you wanted to just view things on the internet, you just click your StumbleUpon thing and it would stumble upon the next thing that you could find, and you could register your site for it. And then you categorized your site. Like there was a category for preparedness and survivalism. So I did that. But it also turned out you could buy very cheap advertising on there. Now, this seems like a really stupid little thing that's not going to do much to grow your business. But when you're starting with zero, That was a big way I springboard my business. I bought AdSense, not a huge amount, but I bought AdSense and I did SEO. And I did a bunch of other shit. And like half of what I did was at least somewhat positively effective, and half of what I did had no real result. But that's what you do. You throw everything at the wall and you see what sticks and you do more of that. I did data mining of my own analytics. So when I had all of a sudden a whole bunch of traffic coming in for people that were just going on Google and looking for pistol caliber carbine, I reinforced the SEO around that episode and I made more content about pistol caliber carbines. That's just one example, right? I did all that because I was starting from the ground up with a new business. Even though I had lots of business experience and marketing experience, I grabbed on everything that was available. 20 years later, I'm kind of like that old farmer Joel Salatin talks about. I'm trying to always be embracing the new, but you don't see me on TikTok much, do you? Right? There's a lot of things that the newer business is going to use. AI, though, is the thing that you have to use. So you need to learn how to use it. If you want to learn AI for random stuff, not for business operations and marketing and building business, then that this course isn't. Don't take it. But if you want to head down that path, this is the blueprint for success in that space. And you can find it at jackslaws.com under courses. Or you can go to jackslaws.com/countdown and sign up there. There's a line system in place that you can use to sign up. All right. Now, the other thing you can do is focus on your personal health. This is the silver bullet that people refuse to put in their gun. I want you, the next time you go out, especially if you are in reasonably good shape, the next time you go to like a Costco or a Walmart, I just want you to like stop shopping for 5 minutes and just open your eyes, stay at head height, body level, and just walk around and look at people and ask yourself how many of these people are legitimately healthy and how many of them have serious health conditions. One of the biggest expenses that we have in our country as individuals and collectively is healthcare, mainly through health insurance. And we have been sold a bill of goods that health insurance is healthcare. That's retarded. That's like saying auto insurance is car care. Home insurance is home care. And by creating that lie and selling it to people, people have bought into the pill for every ill, which benefits the pharmaceutical companies, the medical device makers, the medical test and measurement people, the doctors, the nurses, and the hospitals. That's who benefits from that. The largest sector of growth in our economy for the last 25 years is the health sector. Almost like the mass of total new jobs created has either been people going to work for government, federal, state, and local, or into the healthcare system, or both. Right? So we're building this entire false economy on sick people. And there's an amazing amount of expense that goes down with it. You hear the heart tugging stories all the time. I have to buy insulin for $1,000 a month. Oh, were you born with diabetes? No, I got type 2 diabetes. No, you gave yourself type 2 diabetes. Don't give yourself type 2 diabetes. What's dialysis going to cost you? I don't care what kind of insurance you have. Right? What's it cost you to lose your foot? What is it costing you in your ability to be productive, to be unhealthy? Right? I'm not saying everybody needs to be ripped, you know, be on testosterone or steroids and slam an iron every day. That's one great way if you want to do it. I don't know that I would do the steroid part. Right? But not everybody needs to be like a full athlete, but at least think about the food you put in your mouth. Stop eating garbage. If you think quality food's expensive, why do you pay for medical care when your feet are falling off and your kidneys are blowing up? Don't let it happen. And if it's happening, reverse it now. It's only going to get harder. It's only going to get harder. So focus on personal health, the largest expense outside of housing most people have. Most people are actually spending more total on their health cost, their total real health cost, than they are on their cars. I don't know if it's as true as it used to be because cars are getting stupid now. But if you think about it, like that's your health insurance. That's the part, if you have employer provided or partially provided, that's what your employer is paying for your health insurance that you never see. That's real money. If that employer didn't have to spend that money on that, they could spend it on you and your wages. They would have to, because the other people competing for your labor would do as well. That's all the cost outside of what your health insurance covers. When you look at that, you know, there's a lot of families are spending $20,000 a year just on health care, but a lot of it's going to insurance companies. And a lot of it is unnecessary. We have taken no measure in this country to improve health in 50 years. We just haven't. At a national level, we haven't done it. The last closest thing was Ronald Reagan's health and fitness plan with the physical fitness test in grade school. And let me tell you, I was a kid in school back then. No one really took it seriously. We did some pull-ups and they checked off a checklist of how many you could do. And like, I think it was like a broad jump and some other shit. Girls had to do a hang or whatever. And nothing happened if you couldn't do it. And we never did it again. Like, oh, you failed. So let's know. Right. And fixing the health of kids doesn't really help the adults. And in 1980, 1982, et cetera, we were a lot healthier of a country than we are now. There's been no effort to make us healthier, and there's been no effort to drive down the cost of care itself. The only person who's done anything in that realm at all is Trump. Trump has done some things to drive down the cost of medications and treatment, but not enough to really matter, not enough to really move the needle. And he's been fought every step of the way on it. Every step of the way. How about this? You have to eliminate all bad debt. Same thing I've been saying for 20 years, right? Bad debt has to go away. And the most important debt you need to eliminate is anything with a variable interest rate. Because as this shit happens, you ain't seen usurious interest rates yet. You know, you're talking 21% on a car loan is where we're heading here. For people with decent credit, not people with shit credit. People with shit credit won't be able to get one at all. That's where we're headed. But, you know, credit card debt's always been evil to me. You got to get rid of any variable rate interest loan. About the only debt that you should be carrying right now is debt left for cash flow. If you know how to do that, that's okay. With the right LTV, your loan to value ratio of about 3%. That's a different animal we're not going to go into today. Real estate, most people can't just write a check for a house. And you need a place to live, and there's some real advantages to having that. And if your job warrants it, a vehicle, right? If your requirements warrant it, if it's profitable to have a car payment, then it's worth being in debt for a car. But, I mean, we're getting to a point now where, like, most people shouldn't be buying new cars anymore. You should be looking for used vehicles, which they've also ruined that market as well. But you got to get rid of the bad debt. And then this is the big thing. We all draw lots, right, based on when we're born. And if you think back to, like, Roman times, they used to do, like, if a legion performed very badly in battle or did something cowardice or disobeyed an order, do something called decimation. And we use decimation completely wrong today. That means we wiped everybody out. That's not what it meant. If you wiped your whole army out, you didn't have an army anymore. So decimation, decimal, deca, right? Metric system, a tenth. So what that meant is each, let's say, squad of 10 men, the captain of that squad, you know, put in his hand 10 pebbles. And everybody blindly drew a pebble. And let's say 9 of them were white and 1 of them was black. And the guy that got the black pebble, his own people killed him. That was the rules. In a way, that system still exists, but it's generational. And if you're alive now and you've got enough life in front of you that you're going to be here for another 20, 30 years, whether you are a Gen Xer like me or a Gen Z or an alpha, right, that's in diapers or whatever, kindergarten, second grade, like, you know, like fourth grade, like my granddaughter or whatever. You drew a black pebble. You have to live through this. The good news is your people next to you aren't going to stab you with a spear and kill you and throw you in the ground. You get to fight. You get to try. But you better fight. You better fight like the third monkey trying to get on the freaking ark, and it's starting to freaking rain. That's how you're going to have to fight from an economic and productive standpoint going through this. This is not going to be easy. It is not the end of the world. It is not the complete collapse of society. It is not, you know, James Rawls, Patriots coming collapse. It is not all the cities burning, though some may burn, but it is not that type of scenario. It's a modern version of what your grandparents or great-grandparents, or depending on how old you are, maybe your great-great-grandparents had to live through. And you get to live through it in a much longer, black hole type stretched out time horizon. The good news is we have tools to adapt, knowledge, the ability to communicate and organize today like nothing our grandparents and great-grandparents had. But it's time to start using them. What's coming won't be easy, and we can't know what it'll actually look like. It's an unknown. It's an unknown known is really what we're about to deal with. In ways that we don't know what's going to happen. Do the communists take over a third of our government? The real communists, the full-on communists. Because most of our government is communists already, by the way. Just they don't know they're communists. They're pansy communists. The real knives are out from the real communists right now. They're trying like that makes everything worse, and it accelerates because they will grow government even faster during this while they can, because to them that's how you hold it all together. Of course you can't. You can't. There's not enough money to do the things they say they want to do. It doesn't exist. So we don't know what that looks like. Do the reigning fascists maintain control? It looks different, but it's still bad. Do we have pretty much the status quo except the devaluation of everything? That's terrible too. And each one of those ferments that we could end up going down, those time filaments, not ferments, filaments, right? Each one of those time filaments that we could kind of have like this, like multiverse effect. Like if this happens, then that happens and that splits over here. Like every one of them's tough. Every one of them's hard. But the solution's always this. Can you provide for yourself? Can you provide for your family? Can you get yourself to a place where you're relatively secure as crime increases? Because it will. And can you maintain as much agency and autonomy as possible? That is all there is. A survivalizer says third monkey on the heart. Got to remember that. That's not mine. That's old. That's an old meme. It's so old that it's new again, I guess. There's actually a meme of like a monkey with a 45, like a chimp, and he's heading to the ark. It's time to get on, right? You got to fight that way. And it's counterintuitive what you need to do. The survival prepper space is full of people that think run away and hide. Run away and hide where? Like you're not going to stock up enough beans and rice to live until it's over. And you'd be miserable anyway. Build community, build resiliency, build your own personal health, take care of yourself and your family, build your own means of production, and collectively participate in means of production with others. Right? Don't be afraid of the term means of production. Because the communists use it. They use it poorly. That would be like being afraid of the term gun because some people shoot people with guns that they shouldn't shoot. Some people use guns for murder. Like, you're not going to get rid of your guns. Like, you know, the other meme, right? Oh, a child cried. Oh, no, let's burn the Constitution now, right? We don't do that. We don't turn away from perfectly valid concepts because somebody misuses them. The means of production are real. A factory is a means of production. A farm is a means of production. Communists can't build them, so they seize them. We need to build them and defend them. We need to do it individually and collectively, both by voluntary association with people that we want in our lives. With that, I am wrapped up. I want to remind you again, though, that you can come meet me in West Virginia on Saturday this week. That's, I don't know if it's your last reminder, but one of your last reminders. If you come on out, to the West Virginia Homeschool Convention, you can see my talk and the panel that we'll be doing and meet a bunch of other really cool people. It's not very expensive to attend. And if you want to then spend more time, you can come over to the meet and greet at 6:30 to 9:30 at the Brick Salt Bar and Kitchen and Bar. Brick Salt Kitchen and Bar, that's what it's called, at the Marriott Town Center, 6:30 to 9:30. I'll be down there by 6:30, and we'll go from there. Also, if you want to help support the show and you want to put something into your kitchen that can pay for itself really quick, the Victorinox 6-inch semi-stiff bony knife, which I have right here, is one of those tools that will do that for you if you'll gain a little bit of knowledge as well. Meat has gotten very expensive. the person that can wield this properly can make very nice cuts of meat for themselves and their families at a fraction of the cost by buying primals and subprimals and doing that and doing your own work. I mean, even things like factory chicken, it's so much less expensive to process yourself. This is the knife for it. They call it semi-stiff because it is semi-stiff. It is not unflexible, but it's not fully flexible like a fillet knife. This is the knife that more professional meat cutters use than any other individual knife. I have verified that with people that cut meat for a living. They're $27 on sale right now, 35% off. Make money go further, both when you buy your knife and with what your knife does for you. I own three of these. I keep them as sharp as I can. As they decline in sharpness, I just grab a new one, touch it up with a steel until all of them need sharpening, and then I do all my sharpening on one day. I recommend the same approach. They also make this thing with a really cool rosewood handle. It costs like $45 that way. It looks better. This is not a belt knife. This is a utility knife for your kitchen. Get this one. This rubber handle is so much better, especially when you get some myoglobin and blood and grease on your hands. It's just much easier to control. With that, I am going to wrap up. Thank you guys for being here today. I do think I only had one starred question. I'm going to answer that now. If you're still here, you have a question or something you want me to comment on, last call, because I probably missed it if you did it earlier. The only one I got here is 12 Jacquavius, okay? Question, do you think Bitcoin will eventually drive down the price of real estate as people begin sweeping excess investment money into Bitcoin instead of farmland investment properties, et cetera? What you're talking about is demonetizing of one asset by attracting investment from another. I don't really think so. And I'm going to tell you why I don't think real estate is going to take the hit that even people like Michael Saylor says it's going to take. Michael's done something that very few people will ever actually pull off. He's figured out how to buy Bitcoin with other people's money. There's room for some other companies to do this. There's only room for so many to do this. And I believe it can only run for so long. Real estate is something you can always buy with somebody else's money, and you can always leverage the equity that you have in real estate. The most powerful thing about real estate is buying it with somebody else's money and then financing it with somebody else's money or landlording. That is what makes, and you can do that with farmland because you can lease it to farmers who can't afford to buy land anymore. And it's really the only asset that has the track record and proven ability and the system in place to allow for that. So I think the idea that you're going to have everybody getting rid of their real estate to buy Bitcoin, I think it will pull some investment. But I think it will probably pull more of like the ongoing investment, the future investment, the money that's already in real estate. I don't see you pulling it out of there. Now, there are places where like the commies have gone insane, like Mondami in New York, and taxing like, millionaire houses and second homes and stuff like that at really high levels. The issue though is you think that all those rich people are going to sell all their New York real estate and leave. And some of that will happen, but you have to sell it to somebody. And you have to get out from under the leveraged debt that you already have against it. And most of that property is leveraged out the ass. It's actually a much stronger like Chinese finger trap than people realize, at least for right now. And there's a lot of these people that think this experiment with communism in New York City is going to be last exactly one mayoral term. And New York City has become pretty big on one mayoral terms ever since Bloomberg went out the door. Right. So I think that's not likely to happen quite the way some people are forecasting it. And I, as I said today, I don't think Bitcoin is completely immune from the effects of all this. There is a dollar in, dollar out Bitcoin thing. What it will take is companies preferring to receive Bitcoin than dollars. You get there, then you get what they call hyper Bitcoinization. And the state knows this, and this is why they tax the gains on Bitcoin when you spend it. If you can get somehow around that, and there's pieces of the Clarity Act that at least get a start, like it's like a $600 de minimis reduction or where you just anything under $600 that you spend Bitcoin on, you don't have to account for it. That would be a long way because companies are going to start realizing this is something good to put on the balance sheet and being a Bitcoin treasury company is not just for Strategy and Michael Saylor. Bitcoin treasury companies are going to be companies like Steak and Shake that actually have a physical product that they actually sell. It makes sense to at least put some portion of your assets into a non-inflation affected asset, something that over the long term grows in value. And it doesn't make sense to do it with gold. And it's almost impossible to do with gold for a company that's not in the gold business, right? And because there's laws around that. And you can't immediately liquidate or transfer it somewhere else in the world. You can do that with Bitcoin. So I think it's going to be a very strong player, just not the only player. One Dark Horse 24 with his 75th handle of the year says, do you think moving forward using Bitcoin as purchasing power is smart? I don't understand your question. Do you mean spend your Bitcoin? Do you mean use it for leverage? The answer to both of those questions is yes. But if you have to ask the question, you're probably not in a place to do it. Just being honest with you, like I always am, bro. I think right now what makes sense is to stack it. Stack it. Stack it every day. Whatever you can afford, stack it. That does not mean don't invest in other things. If you have a 401k at work and you don't have a brokerage option in it and you can't buy a Bitcoin ETF, keep putting money in there and stack Bitcoin on the outside. Okay. And I think self-sovereign Bitcoin is the most important kind that you're going to have, because when this shit goes parabolic, they are going to go into capital controls and they're going to go after everything. And how do I know that? I don't think that I know that, because I'm a student of history, and every government that goes into this kind of financial distress always goes after the wealth of the citizens. When it happens, it's only temporary. We just need to do it for now to save everything. It's going to be okay. We're going to do all these wonderful programs for you, but we got to take your gold. FDR. You don't even have to look outside of America to see it, right? I am temporarily closing the gold window. 1971, temporary closing of the gold window. 2026, last I checked, that window is still closed, tight as a monkey's butthole, by the way. Now, Seiko Mag, do you think we're still heading towards 30 to 45K Bitcoin you mentioned in the past? I think it's still possible, however, less probable. My gut is what you're seeing right now is anticipating the Clarity Act, all the positive words the Orange Man gave to crypto capital of the world will be the United States and all this shit, which has been said before and very little done with it. I also think that there was a huge move by bear investors, your bears that want markets to go down, to short Bitcoin, and a whole lot of fucking liquidation just happened. That $80,000 number that I think right now we are back under, but that was a number that didn't have to happen for long. It just had to happen, and it liquidated the shit out of a wall of short sellers massively. Now that that has occurred, I think it's very possible that Bitcoin actually retracts from these gains that it just had. Do we get all the way down to that $35,000, $40,000 range now? I don't know. I don't know. It feels like no. And what I'm starting to think is I base the retraction on the historical pattern, and we never actually blew off in the last all-time high. And that all-time high probably should have been more in the 140 range, and that muted the downdraw. But I do not think that the bottom is in yet, and I do not think that, like, we're on a floor right now. I still think we have down period through Q4 into Q1. How far, I don't know. But why do I tell you, right? King of Biltong had to do it semi-stiff. He had to play Beavis, right? Semi-stiff. He said 6 inches too, right? Okay. Yeah, he had to do it. But yeah, I don't teach you the idea of call the bottom and try to go all in. You know, the people say, I'm going to back up the truck when it gets to whatever. It never gets there, and they have no truck and they have no money. They're like our buddy with the changing handles. Like, on and on they go about when to buy. And then you're like, well, how much are you going to buy? They're like, $100. Like, leave me alone. I don't have time for you. Okay? You're just wasting everybody's time with that shit, right? If you take the approach of buying every day and spreading your buyout across time, you benefit. I just covered this yesterday. If in 2020, August 2020, you started buying $10 a day in August of 2020, when we already had the big lift in the market, by the way, we've had a lot of volatility in the middle. Your ROI as of yesterday is 195% on your money. 195%. And we're not recovered yet. If you started buying at the top of the market in this cycle, DCA every day, you're profitable now. Like, it seems like the worst time you could have bought. In fact, you spent less time in the red than the person that started in 2020. The system works if you follow it. Don't try to time the bottom. Don't try to outthink the market. Don't do anything except end every day with a little more than you started with. That's all you have to do. And right now, I'm ending the day with a little less each day as it continually goes up in price. I actually get excited when it goes down. It's just another way to handle things, right? To think differently. When the herd is heading toward a cliff, don't follow it. If the knife is falling, move your feet and get out of the way. Don't try to catch a falling knife. That's what people try to do. They try to catch a falling knife. It's the all-in philosophy. The whole YOLO philosophy. If only back when Dogecoin was a fraction of the penny, I had bought. Yeah, and if it butts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. Shut up. Follow the process. Process beats self-discipline every day. I wrote two books on that. Laws of Life, book one and two. Hey, consider getting a copy. Come see me in West Virginia. Thanks for the additional questions, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow with a great interview. My buddy Billy Bond is coming on. He's got a big online summit coming up. I think it's online. It could be in person, could be both. I don't remember now, but he just kind of like last minute worked him in because he's always been good to me. Every time I have a new book, a new course, he always says, come on my show. So I'm having him on mine to tell you about this health summit. And that's a key thing that we talked about today, right? Improving your health. So Billy will be on tomorrow to talk about that. Billy is a great dude. He's fun to do a podcast with. When we get together, it's always fun. We're kind of old army buddies that just missed each other. Like, we were in country in Panama together, but we might have had a beer together. We're not sure, but we never hung out. But it feels like we did. So tune in tomorrow. Me and Billy will give you a great show. Expert panel will definitely happen this week. It's already done. Come see West Virginia, buy the book. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. Dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have